This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
My name's Louise Douglas. I'm one of the assistant directors here at the National Museum, and I have the pleasure of welcoming you to the National Museum this glorious Sunday afternoon. These two must be really talented for you all to be here on such a gorgeous afternoon. I have to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land on which we're meeting, the Ngunnawal, and acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the city of Canberra and to the region, and acknowledge and welcome any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who may be attending today's event. In fact, I just discovered coming up here, we have 60 Indigenous students from around Australia who are touring the museum this afternoon, and they were contemplating coming to visit us, but I'm not sure we can fit them in. The forum's being recorded for our audio on demand program on the website. This is a really good time to turn off your mobile phones if you've got one. And I think you've all received a self-completion questionnaire, and we would love you to fill it in because we're all the time looking at ways of improving the programs that we offer to you. The format of today's conversation is essentially Gideon is going to say a few words, and John and he are going to have a conversation, and then you're going to get involved. But I think I might leave when that happens up to John and Gideon. But the whole idea is certainly for you to get involved in today's forum. This forum is part of a much wider program of activities around Australian identity. And not surprisingly, Australian identity is a permanent preoccupation of the National Museum. We've just published, with University of New South Wales Press, a terrific book called Symbols of Australia. And we are also travelling at the moment an exhibition which looks at a selection of about 10 symbols. And that exhibition has just opened in the Albury Library and Museum, if you feel like a trip to Albury. The book itself includes about 26 Australian symbols, including, of course, a chapter by Gideon on the baggy green. We're always looking for objects that help tell the story of Australian identity and symbolise what Australia is all about, and indeed you can see the baggy green worn by Australian Captain Greg Chappell, as well as Rod Marsh's baggy yellow, both from 1982, just outside in the showcase, outside the theatre there. It's my great pleasure to introduce John Harms. John is a writer and broadcaster, as I'm sure you know. He's currently director of Manning Clark House in Canberra, and has over the last year or so been responsible for rejuvenating Manning Clark House, so it's now an incredibly important part of Canberra's intellectual landscape. He trained as a historian. He was a history teacher. He writes on a broad range of topics, but sport is really the thing that he loves. If you've seen him on ABC TV's Offsiders, you will know that. And when you look at the list of his publications, which include Confessions of a 13th Man, Memoirs of a Mug Punter, Loose Men Everywhere, The Pearl, Steve Renouf's Story, and the Footy Almanac annuals that he produces, you kind of get the idea that sport is what he really loves. His column No Harm Trying appears regularly in the Canberra Times on Friday, and he loves... Normally when a speaker or person comes to the museum and you get notes from them to introduce them, you paraphrase, you kind of cut bits out. But actually his are so good, I'm just going to read you what he gave me. He loves red wine, short par fours. Now, I think that's something to do with golf. Architecture of golf courses, would that be right? And the Geelong Football Club. His ambition is to lunch for Australia. However, it seems it will be some time before he can thrust his name before the selectors again. He's devoted to his beautiful wife, Susan, and two Little uns Theo and Anna, and he reckons conversation is at the heart of it all. It gives me great pleasure to introduce John Harms to you. Please join me in welcoming him.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Louise. That's very kind words, especially about Manning Clark House, which, hopefully we're developing a program there that's going to be attractive to the people of Canberra and surrounds, and seems to have been. We had GCJD Hague there on Thursday night with Professor Philip Goad, because talking about Professor Philip Goad is the Australia's expert on Robin Boyd, both his architecture and his life as a public intellectual. And, of course, it's the 50th anniversary of the release of The Australian Ugliness, which came out in 1960. And it has been re-released by Text Publishing, a publisher which has at times published our work, Gideon and mine. Certainly four of my books have been through Text Publishing. And it's been a successful re-release. And it's interesting that you could just about cross out 1960 on the title page, the publication page of the book, and put 2006, and it'd probably stand up pretty well. So that was Thursday night, but enough of the advertising from me. It's my pleasure to introduce a very dear friend of mine, GCJD Hague, which is how I refer to him. He's one of the few I know with five names, Gideon, Clifford, Jeremy, David Hague.
Davidson, Dark.
Jeffrey Davidson, right. Hague.
Jeffrey Davidson, yeah.
Sorry, Dave, I've got it wrong all these years. Right. I've only known him for 15 years as well, which is what I'm going to tell you about. Both of us love cricket. Both of us love ideas. Both of us love good writing. Both of us are Geelong Football Club fans.
Another boo, please.
Very happy in recent years. But I, being in Brisbane, I didn't know much about Gideon's early life as a journalist. But he was writing for The Australian at that stage, and it was before you got the little photos. It just was byline Gideon Hague. And so I was reading his pieces, particularly cricket history pieces, and I remember one in the very early days, a profile of Arthur Morris.
Yeah.
Which must have been in the early, 93, 94,
yeah,
somewhere around then.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is just a beautifully researched and crafted piece for me to be reading on over my cup of coffee on a Thursday morning or whatever it was. And then lo and behold, at the University of Queensland, where I was doing my PhD, unfinished, I might add, the box has still got the tape over the top of it. Don't tell my wife. That we were having a conference, a history conference through the Human Movement Studies Department, a history of sport, Australian Society of Sports Historians. And I saw Gideon Hague was going to be one of the participants in the conference. He was reporting on it for The Australian. Mm. He was interested in this organisation called the Australian Society of Sports History. And I said, well, look, I'm helping with this conference. I'll go and pick Gideon up at the airport. So I'm looking for this guy who's about probably 60, given the maturity of his writing and the authority within the writing. So I'm wandering around the airport looking for this 60-year-old. Gideon Hague is there, aged, I think, probably 29. He was wearing what could only be described as dungarees, probably from the gold mines of Ballarat in 1857. A long cricket short sleeve, sleeveless pullover, which probably started as white but was then cream. A jacket such that and I didn't recognise the colours of it either, and a jacket, because Gideon always wears what we call dead man's jackets, which are the ones you pick up from Vinnie's after they've been kicked out, turfed out of home, and badges. And I'd never seen anyone wear badges like this before. I couldn't recognise any of them. And I said, hello, Gideon Hague, and I was amazed because he's only 29, I was expecting 60. I said, oh, hello, John Harms, Gideon Hague, blah, blah, blah. I've just got to ask, what are the badges? And he said, well, that's, I think, was Dennis Compton as a child, was it?
Or? I think Compo was there. I think Doug Walters as a child. Might have been Imran Khan as well.
So I thought, this is one unusual character who actually has not only Imran Khan, but Imran Khan as a child on a badge. Who made them? Oh, I made them myself. I'm a badge maker. So let me introduce badge maker Gideon Hague. A We've become very good friends since then, but let's open the conversation, Gideon, and I'll invite you to be part of it fairly soon. We're talking about the Baggy Green today. Were the editors, Melissa Harper and Richard White, right in putting the Baggy Green in this collection of essays on the symbols of Australia?
Yeah, that's a good question. Can I just welcome everyone here today? John and I have spoken to... John was calculating before that this is a bigger crowd than the last seven gigs that we've done together.
Put together. The one at Kilmore was a ripper.
It's probably fair to say that the words bowled over by Gideon Haig have never been so large, and they don't happen all that often these days, and they happen less often every year, but it's nice to see them there above the Baggy Green. As close as I've come to the Baggy Green is owning a small one down here. I was so confident there was going to be about three people here today that I bought it on the assumption that I could just simply pass it round to the people in the audience. That might not be practical now. The Baggy Green has a very interesting history. It's not the history that you would perhaps expect, considering the iconic significance that it's taken on in Australia. And I think that's partly because we have a very... Our sort of discovery of cricket history and our discovery of cricket antiquity is a relatively recent invention. You know, when I was growing up in the 1970s and following Australian cricket, there wasn't the same kind of obsession with the immediate past. We lived in a very comfortable present. I'm not sure that I knew anything about the players in the 1960s when I was growing up in the 1970s. It didn't seem to matter to me very much. It's interesting that I think in the last 15 years, a period of convulsive change in international cricket and in Australia, that we've clutched ever more tightly to symbolic reflections of the game that we love so well. John was noting the other day that when he grew up in the 1970s, he dreamed of playing for Australia, but he'd never dreamed of wearing the baggy green cap. We didn't even use the expression in the 1970s. When it came for me to write this piece, the earliest usage of the expression that I could find was in an article in Cricketer in about 1970 by a writer from England. So it was something that the English discovered about us rather than something that we boasted of. I think the first time it was used in a way that really caught the public eye was there was a book in about 1981 called Warriors in Baggy Green Caps by a Western Australian journalist called Ian Brayshaw. I'd never asked Ian where he came up with that expression from. There have been references to green caps, there have been references to baggy caps, but not until I think that particular title was the expression used in as one. It's interesting when you look back at the very early Australian sides, where we sometimes fondly imagine all our historical associations have derived from, the sort of pre-modern period of Australian cricket, there is a huge variety of uniforms in which Australian teams play. Of course, Australia wasn't a nation at the time. It was a concatenation of colonies who got together to play cricket as one without necessarily, I think, entirely coalescing. There was no national cricket government. There was no Australian Cricket Board until 1905. The teams were basically put together by the leading players from each of the colonies who would form a kind of a limited company with sufficient money to get themselves over to England, and they would pay themselves from the proceeds of the gate takings. It's difficult to analyse the early history of the Australian cricket colours because we're often looking at black and white photos, but... There are some interesting visual clues to the way in which Australian cricketers represented themselves. In fact, I saw one the other day at the National Portrait Gallery. If you go there, you'll see Frederick Spofforth in a cartoon from Vanity Fair by a cartoonist called Leslie Ward, known as Spy. He's wearing the blazer and cap of the 1878 Australian team. Which was the first Australian team to really achieve great fame in England. They bowled the MCC out at Lord's for 33 and 19 and won a famous game in a day. They wore a blue and white striped blazer and a cap without a brim of blue and white as well. In 1882, when Australia won their first test match in England, the team was dressed in red, yellow and black. That's the team that, in winning that test match at the Oval, inaugurated the tradition of the Ashes. In 1884, they wore navy blue. In 1886, they wore red, white and blue because the backer for that particular team was the Melbourne Cricket Club, which was the biggest and oldest and richest cricket club in Australia. It probably still is. It's the oldest continuous sporting club. And in those early days, as the venture of going to England became more and more significant, culturally significant and financially significant, the players required the backing of a large institution, and de facto that was the Melbourne Cricket Club. We still don't have a national cricket government. In fact, we don't have a national cricket government or an attempt at such until 1893, when the colonial cricket associations, New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia, form a body called the Australasian Cricket Council. They organised the 1893 tour of England, not very successfully because it was a very poor team that was beaten very soundly, but they had a first go at creating a national cricket raiment. Their idea was a blue blazer and a blue cap with a crest on it, a primitive Australian coat of arms with the legend Advance Australia along the bottom. Now, that team was a very poor and unsuccessful team that pulled itself to pieces in the course of the tour. So there was no success for the Australasian Cricket Council to boast of. And when they next tried to put forward the idea of a national cricket garb, in January 1895, a man called John Portis from New South Wales put a motion before the Australasian Cricket Council saying we should have a green cap. I think he called it a gum tree green cap and an Australian coat of arms. The vote lapsed without a seconder. So there was no support by any of the other colonies for national cricket colours. And it's funny, there's no real need in Australia at that stage, or no real sense that in which the colonies feel as though they need some sort of symbolic expression that draws them together. Until, it's interesting, in 1899, and it'd be interesting to get John's views on this, because I know John, the first time I met John, was he was delivering a paper on the 1899 Australian Tour of England, which takes place, of course, immediately before Federation. But the Australian team going to England in 1899 wear a uniform, a cap of sage green, and they carry a flag with them, a green flag, with an Australian coat of arms, once again with the Advance Australia legend, and they fly the flag over their hotel in England, the Inns of Court Hotel in London, which is where they made their base. Now, that tour was organised by the Melbourne Cricket Club again, and it was immediately after the collapse of the Australasian Cricket Council, which basically had no funding. It was really put together by a few like-minded spirits from the different colonies, but it had no particular financial support and it had no support from the players. But my supposition, my theory, which I present in Symbols of Australia, is that because there was some anxiety about a private club putting together a team to tour England and some desire to create some sort of national identity that was separate from the club, that the players, perhaps in cahoots with the Melbourne club, thought that it would be good to have a uniform that separated them from the private club, to look more like a national team and not so much the expression of a big and wealthy private institution from Melbourne. John, you've written about 1899. Perhaps you'd like to talk about the way in which that team expressed some of the pre-Federation dreams of Australian unity.
Well, it certainly did, and maybe that's a point for both of us to take up on, and that's the degree to which... I mean, this discussion is fine sitting here in 2010, looking back at the late 19th century, but did cricket matter then, and hence do the colours matter... And what was the meaning that the broader population put... I'll come back to 1899 in a minute. But what was the broader meaning that was projected onto the side or discovered in the side in that late 19th century? Do you agree with Mandel's thesis that it did contribute to a sense of national consciousness?
I think it did, with one qualification. It mattered when we were successful. Because it's interesting, there's... In the 1880s... after the period of Australian success. They go to England and they lose a test match narrowly in 1880. They win this fantastic test match in 1882, which is very important. It's where the Ashes tradition is inaugurated. There is a lot of interchange of teams in the 1880s, but Australian teams are not particularly successful. And in fact, cricket in that period was regarded as in the doldrums, really. And even though it was really the only game in town as far as national sport was concerned, I don't think it really captivated Australians in the way that it did from the 1890s, and in particular one tour, the 1894-5 tour of Australia by Drewy Stoddart's England team, which is a fantastic tour. It's a 5-test match series. Australia lose narrowly in the final test by a margin of 3-2, having lost the first test match after they'd forced England to follow on. It's the first test series where the publics in both countries have been able to follow it in real time, because it's it's immediately after the cable is connected from Australia to England, and you are able to get real-time coverage, virtually real-time coverage of the tour in England in the Pall Mall Gazette, who pay an awful lot of money to get wire scores in England. And apparently it was followed by everyone in England. It was followed by Queen Victoria. The England team coming out here were very, very popular, and they created a legacy of goodwill that followed them. And that really revives Australian cricket in the colonies. It's often thought of by cricket historians as the beginning of what's been called the golden age of cricket, which lasts from round about then up to the start of the First World War. And when Australia lose that test series narrowly, and they also lose narrowly a test series in England in 1896, Australians really rediscover cricket big time, because their team is competitive again, and it really matters, because Australia is just short of supremacy. There's nothing quite as tantalising as being just short of winning, because, of course, when you win, it's just so much more satisfying and so much more liberating. And Australia wins in 1897-8, and they win again in England in 1899 by the odd test. It's the first 5-test series in England, and it's won narrowly by Australia. It features the first series of a great batsman in Victor Trumper, and that is the rise of Victor Trumper and the beginnings of a distinctively Australian cricket consciousness are very important. It's interesting
that... And he wears the cap.
And he's extremely sentimental and attached to that cap because he succeeds in that cap. He makes a test century in his first test match at Lord's. He makes 135 not out, and he wears that cap religiously. And in fact, there are references by other players to Trumper's deep personal sentimental attachment to his cap. And if you're a cricketer, John and I are both cricketers, for better or worse, but there is something both nostalgic about your first cricket cap or the caps that you've worn in your career, and you have a superstitious attachment to those pieces of gear with which you succeed. And I think that's one of the reasons why this idea of the green cap and the green uniform take root in Australia during this period, because Australia succeeds in them. Cricketers, when they succeed, don't want to change anything about the way in which they're playing the game. So I think that's one of the reasons why Australians cling with ever more passion to this symbol of their united endeavour.
To illustrate Gideon's point about 94-95 and then especially 1896, when the cable stopped breaking, which was one of the things that allowed this communication, it kept breaking. Anyway, in 1896, there's a famous photo from The Age, middle of July, Melbourne. Imagine how cold it is. There are 10,000 people waiting for the cable to come once every 15 minutes, at which point someone from The Age comes out to the blackboard and writes the new score up, and everyone cheers, and then they sit and talk for another 10 minutes in the freezing. Now, cricket nuts, that's cricket nuts. Mm. So somewhere along the way, and this was probably what Gideon was alluding to regarding my research of 1899, somewhere this following of bands of cricketers who've been set up by entrepreneurs to entertain almost, people start to view these sides with some sort of notion of national representation, which is interesting because Federation, of course, is only 1901. Now, nothing's inevitable in history, and I'm certainly no determinist, but there's this sense even then that something would come of these six colonies on this landmass and that they would form a national entity. And the degree to which cricket contributes to that is at least interesting, if not significant. Mm. The other way around is to look at 1899 and look at the frustration of George Reid and some of the politicians that they can't get anyone interested in federation. Why not? Because the Australians are playing cricket in England. And so if you go to the Bulletin of 1899, there's probably 8 to 10 cartoons, front of the Bulletin cartoons, of political matters put in cricketing terms. And in fact, one of them is, if you can't bring Mohammed to the mountain, bring the mountain to Mohammed, which is about putting political stuff in cricketing terms so that at least then you'll have some sort of impact on federation. To sort of exemplify that, you've also got in Australia in 1899, and rugby union didn't get organised as quickly as cricket did. Reverend Molyneux brings the Poms to Australia, the rugby side. Now, the Poms are here at the moment. This is probably not a good day to be talking about it, having gone down 21-20 last evening. But Reverend Molyneux, and Banjo Paterson wrote a poem about Reverend Molyneux. He was the skipper of the English side. And there's a lovely cartoon, again in the Bulletin. The Australian people are all looking at England, to the cricket, and to wherever they were playing the English test, English-Australian rugby test matches, and said, you can only keep your eye on two things at once. There's no way you're going to be able to keep your eye on three things. So forget the politics. It's the sport that people are more interested in.
Another interesting interface between politics and cricket in Australia during this period is how many of these key politicians have gained often their first experience of administration through cricket. Edmund Barton's a classic example. He umpired a test match. He was a member of the New South Wales Cricket Association. George Reid, Vice President of the New South Wales Cricket Association. C.C. Kingston, Vice President of the South Australian Cricket Association. Sir George Turner, member of the Melbourne Cricket Club. And Alfred Deakin, of course, in 1904 gives the famous 311s speech. So this idea of there being being able to reach people through cricket and reach cricket through people is fundamental, I think, to the early Australian political experience.
Didn't Barton umpire the famous riot game in Sydney?
He did indeed. That's right, 1878-9. Yep, Lord Harris's team.
There you are. Okay, so take it beyond now federation. And from then on, Australian cricket sides wear a green cap, if they wear a cap at all. What's the style of that cap?
The important thing that happens in Australia in the immediate aftermath of federation is that federation gives rise to this idea of there finally being some sort of national control for cricket. Because up until then, it had been a loose-knit coalition of the different state associations, and the only place that they really combined their efforts was in the management of test matches and sending players abroad to England. And even then, the Melbourne Cricket Club was the de facto seat of power in Australian cricket. In the immediate aftermath of federation, there's the first talk of a national cricket board. In May 1905, the associations of New South Wales and Victoria put their heads together and say it's high time that not only did we have a national cricket government, but that the team was a genuine providing proceeds to the development of the game in Australia, at least as we embody it. Because up until then, the players going to England had basically divided the spoils at the end of the tour, which meant that they were immensely lucrative endeavours. The tours didn't take place all that often, but it didn't matter that you weren't paid very much for cricket in between times. If you managed to get £800 to £1,000 from touring England, as the players did in 1899, 1902, 1905... you could really set yourself up for the next 3 or 4 years. Players like Warwick Armstrong didn't have to work in between times. They held they held part-time jobs whenever they weren't playing cricket. So they called themselves amateurs because they weren't paid wages as professionals would expect to be paid. But they weren't really they weren't amateurs. They were extracting quite significant emoluments from the game of cricket. So this idea of the laissez-faire and mercantile spirit of Australian cricket runs up against, I guess you could call them narcs and straighteners in the bureaucracy of the state cricket associations, who think that we are the reputable people to be running Australian cricket along amateur lines. There's this desire to enforce a kind of amateur code, at least a code that isn't so obviously mercenary in its motivations. So the Australian Cricket Board is formed in 1905. I won't go into the battle that ensued between the players and the board, but eventually the board is triumphant. In 1908, the board decides that on the vote of a man called Mostyn Evan from South Australia, that they will wear a uniform of green, sage green and gold. And it is a cap. It's a tight-fitting skull cap. It's a very, very dark green, almost an olive green. And it has a coat of arms. It's the original Australian coat of arms on the gift of King Edward VII. It's a coat of arms with broken up into four. You can actually see the vestiges of that original coat of arms are still on the cap at the moment. It's broken up into four. Originally, I think the kangaroo and the emu were actually transposed. That's a change from the original cap. That sun, of course, is gone from the original cap. The legend then was Advance Australia, again, at the bottom. The cap changes. The coat of arms changes in 1912. There's a supplementary coat of arms on the gift of King George V, but the cap does not change. We still have the original pre-modern Australian coat of arms up here.
So that's still on today's cap.
That's still on today's
cap.
That's
the remarkable
So
thing
it's
about
not
it.
The Australian coat of arms. That's an assumption that many people have, that it's our coat of arms. In fact, it predates the Australian coat of arms. The legend Advance Australia disappears in 1931 too. It becomes Australia. The other major change is that in the early days, the year of the tour or the year of the test series in which the cap was worn was put on the cap, so that the caps were actually readily identifiable. That fashion changes in the 1970s and it goes back to a cap like that with no date, no particular provenance, There's a general idea at that stage that maybe we shouldn't be giving out caps quite as indiscriminately as we have been, because, you know, if you went on tour to England, you got two caps. You got two Australian pullovers and two Australian caps. And that kind of general lack of discrimination about the way in which the cap was used meant that it wasn't regarded as a particularly special object. Players going overseas ritually distributed caps to friends who wanted souvenirs. Don Bradman ended his career without any of his caps. Ian Chappell doesn't have any of his caps. Richie Beno doesn't have any of his caps. They just gave them away in their travels to people who wanted them. It seems as though people who are outside the Australian team actually valued the symbol more than those who are in the Australian team. Bill Brown said to me that, you know, in my era, which was the 1930s and 1940s, the cap wasn't important. It was something that you threw in the bottom of your case. Didn't really matter if it got dirty. It was a piece of equipment rather than a symbol of your belonging to a special elite club.
In fact, my childhood memory is such that in those 70 sides of the Chappell era, I can't really think. Greg Chappell wore a cap to bat, but Ian Chappell, I think of in that flower pot terry toweling hat that he used to wear at first slip. I can't really think of too many in the field. But by the way, when did it go to this sort of baggy shape? There's a photo of Trumper out there, I think, where he's definitely got the skull
cap. He's got a skull cap. The change is basically in line with fashion. The first team that seems to wear a baggy cap is the 1920-21 team, which is Warwick Armstrong's team that went to that in Australia won 5-0 and in England won the first three test matches of the series. It was the record consecutive number of Ashes wins until Steve Waugh's team quite recently. So it's auspicious that it should have happened at that particular time. It's also, I think, a reflection of, in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, the last players who can remember a player-centric model of Australian cricket, where the players ran the game rather than bureaucrats, the Australian Cricket Board. The last player of that era is really Warwick Armstrong. By this stage, the idea of there being a centralised cricket bureaucracy has very thoroughly taken root, and the players are playing for the representatives of the cricket administration in Australia rather than for themselves.
So what happens then, Gideon, that Harper and White, two academics, then look at this and say, when we're trying to find symbols of Australia, the baggy green cap should now be one? Because it seems what you're describing up until the 1980s, perhaps, would suggest it shouldn't be in the book. But now, over the last 25 years, I think you can mount a very strong case that it should be.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's an interesting tradition, in the sense that it's an imagined tradition. It's a kind of an invented tradition. I mean, Australian cricket is not invented. The Ashes is not invented. The Australian cricket team is certainly not invented. Don Bradman is not invented. But it was almost as though we needed some sort of symbol that brought all those separate ideas and all those separate principles and all those separate personalities under the one symbol. We needed a symbolic embodiment of our personal attachments to Australian cricket. And the baggy green actually suited that rather well. It's interesting, in the 1990s, one of the reasons why the baggy green was not particularly venerated was that it had no protection. It had no copyright protection. It had no trademark protection. There had been attempts in the 1970s and 80s to ensure that the cap was not commercially exploited by people who basically were putting no money back into Australian cricket. I think one of the key artefacts in the development of the baggy green is ironically an advertisement that was done in the mid 90s by Cooper's Brewing. Some of you remember it. It's six stubbies, and the tops have been rendered as baggy green caps. And the Australian Cricket Board went, hang on, how can they use our symbol, the symbol of Australian cricket, for their commercial ends? That's ridiculous. So the Australian Cricket Board investigated the rights that they had, the intellectual property rights they had over the baggy green cap, and they found that they had none. So, in fact, in the late 1990s, 1998, the marketing manager of the Australian Cricket Board, who was a guy called David Fovey, said, well, look, if we can't control the commercial usages of our cap, then why don't we dispense with the baggy green cap and invent our own cap that we can copyright? So, you know, this is 1998 we're talking about. This is actually sort of within the period of the baggy green ascendancy. The players have actually begun to discover it by this period. The institution of the players wearing the cap in the first session of a test match has been introduced by Mark Taylor. Steve Waugh, his successor, introduces the idea of new players in the team being presented with a cap on the occasion of their first test match. So the players have discovered the tradition of the baggy green at the very moment when the Australian Cricket Board is actually thinking of seeing if it can do without it. And what happens at that point, I won't go into it in detail here. If you're interested, you can find my account of it in a book called Inside Story, which is the official history of Cricket Australia. Dennis Rogers, who was the chairman of the Australian Cricket Board, went to John Howard to see if he could get some help at getting trademark protection for the baggy green. And Howard, a cricket tragic, God bless him, I think that's a silly term because there's nothing tragic about cricket. It's wonderful. thanks to the agency of John Howard, who, funny enough, at the same time was helping the Bradman Foundation and the Bradman Museum trademark and protect the name of Bradman from unauthorised commercial exploitation, facilitates copyright protection for the baggy green. It's at the time when the Australian Cricket Board also create their website, which if you visit it is called www.baggygreen.com.au, and we begin to think in terms of this kind of both ancient and modern tradition of Australian cricket. It's a very recent invention, but somehow it connects us to all the things that we like about Australian cricket and all the things that we value. So in that sense, it may be a recent tradition, but it's an extremely valuable tradition at the same time.
Well, as someone really interested in meaning, now is the time for me to ask you what it symbolises. What are the meanings of the baggy green? What are these things that you're talking about that it actually symbolises?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the idea of the baggy green has gone forth and multiplied is because it suits everyone concerned. It suits the players who under Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh, wanted to build a kind of a specialness, a kind of esprit de corps in the team. Players do get a sentimental attachment to their cap. Steve Waugh was an immensely superstitious cricketer in his time. If you read his autobiography, he, of course, always batted with the same red rag in his pocket. He also had this idea that if he found a ladybird on himself in the field, he'd try and protect that ladybird in the course of a day's play. I mean, players do have weird superstitions. Perhaps later on I might ask people from the audience what sort of superstitions they've had as cricketers. Everyone's got them. If you've played cricket at any level, it's a very unusual cricketer who doesn't have some sort of ritual that they follow in getting ready for playing cricket, or some piece of gear that they regard as particularly precious. The other people that it suits are the administrators, who were trying to build some sort of intellectual property that they could control, that they could market, and they could sell, and that they could monetize in the modern vernacular. It suits everyone concerned sentimentally when they see Michael Clarke on the eve of his first Test century in his maiden Test match in India in October 2004, when he says, "I don't want to wear my helmet. I'm calling for my baggy green because I want to be in the lineage of great Australian players who've all worn this before." No one doesn't get a good feeling out of that. Administrators,
why
players.
Though, Gideon? What does it mean? I mean, what are the human qualities that it's supposed to embody? Yeah. You know, well, is it courage? Is it what are the things that the baggy green?
Well, like all good symbols, it's versatile. It means whatever meaning you choose to attach to it. This is a very liberal, very generous, very expansive kind of icon.
Would you believe the Anzac tradition is in?
Well, indeed, cap? Indeed. Although I'm wondering where the New Zealand quotient is. Of course, it also suits sponsors who want to attach themselves to a premium product. And there is something special and something exclusive. Perhaps that's what it embodies chiefly. It's exclusive. If you get one of these, it's precious. And there's this kind of folklore that's grown up around it that you get one in the course of your career. Now, that's a very recent development, that you only got one. Because Steve Waugh got his original baggy green playing for Australia under-19s in the mid-1980s. In those days, they were just giving them out all over the place. Ken Eastwood tells a fantastic story. Ken Eastwood, some of you might know, he played one Test match for Australia in 1971.
Five and naught.
Bowled snow in the second innings. But he made five runs, one Test match, and he got two caps because Alan Barnes, the secretary of the Australian Cricket Association, gave him one cap. It didn't fit. Gave him another cap that fitted, didn't bother to get back the first cap. So he managed to walk away with two caps. And in fact, Bob Merriman, later the Australian Cricket Board chairman, said that Alan Barnes used to throw around baggy green caps like a man distributing newspapers, throwing them onto people's front lawns.
Just on the cap, and perhaps on the Australian cricket side generally, and certainly on the Australian captain, what role did John Howard have in elevating these symbols of Australia? Say with Mark Taylor, for example.
Yeah. Look, I don't think he originated them, but he certainly helped facilitate them. And the baggy green is, of course, fundamentally a conservative symbol. It attaches us to the past. It attaches us to tradition. It attaches us to the best of Australia, the cleanest, the purest, and the most successful part of Australia, because whatever else we've achieved, we have been very successful and predominantly successful in cricket. Wherever we have gone, there's never really been a prolonged downturn in Australian cricket in the way that, for instance, there has been in English cricket since probably around about the Suez Crisis. So I think John Howard was, like any good adroit politician, he saw something going past and he attached himself to it. But then so did the players. The players realised that the iconography of the baggy green made them special, made them stand out, made them the members of an exclusive club. And There is something wonderfully romantic and evocative about a player's attachment to the cap. No doubt about it.
To take that moment, and I know we talked about it on Offsiders as a bit of a watershed moment in the West. I think it was the West Indies where, rather than wearing the Australian cap for a game against one of the provincial sides, the Australians wore the sponsor's cap.
Yes.
Now, for a long time through the 20th century, it's certainly in my imagination, the collection, the 11 who were selected to play for Australia, the 12 selected were the representatives of Australian cricket. That there was this sort of apex at the top of, of the very the grassroots base, and whether you were playing you'd under thirds or university firsts or whatever, that you were on this path that could you could wind up at the top. I felt at that moment that suddenly we were looking at the 12 or the 11 cricketers who were representing the entity that is cricket, the commercial entity that is Cricket Australia.
Sponsored by Carlton Innanite Breweries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has there been a change in understanding of what the cricket side is?
I think, look, I'll talk about that moment in a that particular incident in a second. I think one of the seminal moments in the the proselytising of the baggy green cult was the occasion in 2001 where the Australian team, stopping off on their trip to England, go to Gallipoli, and they reenact the famous photo of the game taking place on Shell Green, and thereby explicitly identify with the Anzac tradition that that John was talking about before. In fact, Peter Cosgrove comes out and says, "These players are the modern day Anzacs." And it was that particular period in Australian history where I think almost every expression of patriotic symbolism was couched somehow in with a martial association.
I'll just read that, Gideon. They're our sporting Anzacs. We want that. We want that cricket team to embody all those marvellous Australian characteristics we prize. You know, fair play, good humour, toughness, success. They represent all Aussies, just as the Aussies who thought. Who fought in those trenches represented all Australians.
Yeah, it's Australian. It's interesting choice of language too, because it's kind of straight from the English public school tradition, isn't it? By invoking the spirit of fair play, that's very much a construction of the rugby school of the 1850s.
It sort of fits in with Bernard Wimpress's view too, that during the history wars, you know, of course, the black armband view of history was one of the terms that was up for discussion all of the time. Bernard Wimpress suggested that John Howard had a white picket fence view of history, not just in relation to the 50s front yard and suburban Australia and you know the so-called forgotten Australians of Menzies, but also in terms of the cricket oval.
Mm. I find that interesting that, and I don't think it was as premeditated or as cynical an exercise as this, but it was interesting that in the summer of 2000-2001, the Australian team had actually come under considerable criticism, not for its prowess on the field, but for its behaviour. And there had been several incidents on Australia's tour of India. In particular, there was that Michael Slater had that terrible meltdown where he claimed to catch off Rahul Dravid at square leg and then remonstrated fiercely with the umpire. It was very embarrassing. There was a lot of bad feedback about the Australian team at the time. They were in pretty bad odour with a portion of the public. But they go to Gallipoli. They identify with this. They identify with this other powerful sort of patriotic totem of the Anzacs. And Steve Waugh was widely lauded for that trip. In fact, I remember, because I was in England in 2001, reporting the test series for The Guardian, the English commentators were very impressed by the way in which the Australians showed, by this gesture, their attachment to their country and to a particular spirit of competition, and they compared that unflatteringly to the England team, who they thought, I remember that James Lawton's line was that the Aussies play cricket because they love Australia, our lot play because they get paid for it.
I see in the baggy green, wandering around the MCG, there's quite a lot of really chauvinistic nationalism at work amongst sections of the crowd. Is there a bit of Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi in the baggy green tradition?
Yeah,
look, or is that unfair?
Well, I think that probably is a little bit unfair, because I think because it's attached to cricket tradition and because it's attached to the institution of the Test match, which of course is, as far as John and I are concerned, the definitive form of the game, but it's the longest lasting and most enduringly successful form of the game, I don't necessarily see it as strongly attached to chauvinistic expressions of Australianness as others. I identify that more with one day cricket and perhaps more recently with 2020 cricket. But I think it's strange that Cosgrove should use that particular collection of assumptions, because they're the assumptions that we tend to associate with Test match cricket. We think of Test match cricket as embodying the best of cricket and all that cricket connotes.
How much do you think, too, it's because some of the great cricketers have been photographed or caricatured, say, for cigarette cards, and I see there is an actual photograph of a cigarette card in the book. The fact that we see Bradman not in a white floppy hat or hatless, he's actually in this baggy green, and equally you could look at some of the heroic players, in cricketing terms, of the last century and say, so too, they've been photographed in that way.
Yeah, that is interesting. I think that's quite powerful, quite powerful symbolism. It's interesting that the Australian Cricket Board had no compunction until the 1990s about players appearing in advertisements wearing their Australian cap. So the baggy green was actually subtly commercialised by players wearing it in advertisements for everything from cigarettes to canned fruit. But the board wasn't worried because the board had a very uneasy relationship with commerce and they just preferred not to think about it at all. If you look at Australian cricketers appearing in advertisements over the last 10 years, you'll notice that none of them were wearing their Australian caps, unless they're advertising the Australian team. The board will not allow them to, you know, if they're appearing in an advertisement for a bat or a set of pads or a mobile phone, they're not allowed to wear their caps because that is this idea of protection from the sullying of mercenary impulses, and the idea that players shouldn't be allowed to harness the mythology of the cap for their own commercial benefit.
Do you think it will ever be available as merchandise in the same way? Do you think the All Black jumper, the only way you can get an All Black jumper forever, was if you won it, if you were picked for New Zealand? And equally up until now although that demonstrates otherwise, Gideon, but do you think it will become part of the merchandise program of Cricket Australia?
Look, I find it hard to give a question, hard to give an answer to that, because I so want it not to. But I don't think it will. I know that there has actually been talk of merchandising the Australian cable knit sweater, because for some years the Australian Wool Corporation was a sponsor of Australian cricket, and that there was talk at one time about, well, you know, we've got this, and that the Australian sweater is actually a very beautiful thing in its own right, and it has quite a strong tradition too. I know, having written the history of Australian cricket of Cricket Australia, they have talked at times about maybe allowing that out for some sort of minimum commercial exploitation, but they've always pulled back from doing so. I think if they've got their reservations about the jumper, they certainly have those reservations about the cap. But I think a lot of that depends on the way in which the players wear it and the way in which the players continue to regard it. And the players have actually become more protective of it rather than less. I think perhaps because over the last 3 years, we've probably undergone more change in cricket than we have in the last three decades. And it's always in periods of convulsive change that we tend to hang on to those things that remind us of conservative values of tradition and continuity. So perhaps, in short answer to the question, perhaps the fact that the game has undergone so much change in such a short period of time has actually shored up the imperviousness of the cap to commercial exploitation.
I've got a question, but I reckon one of these guys is going to come up with the same question I'm going to ask, so I'll throw it open first and we'll see how we go. Questions from the floor? Yeah. Oh, sorry, we need mics. Of course we do. Mm-hmm. We're recording. Just I'll sing the girl from Ipanema for a second whilst you get the microphones there.
Do you want a name from the speaker as well, Mary?
Yes, if you state your name.
Thank you.
Speak clearly into the mic.
So, did you hear that? State your name when you get the mic and speak clearly into the microphone. Thank you.
I'm Faye Goddard. When players are presented with a cap, they say this is cap number 380, whatever. Is that number actually in the cap? As a, I guess what I'm suggesting is if the number's in the cap, they can always relate back to who it belonged to.
Yeah. They introduced that.
It's on the shirt.
It's on the shirt as well. Yeah. I think that came in around about.
Mid-90s?
In the late 1990s. The idea of the players being numbered goes back a little bit earlier, to the early 1990s. But there was this celebrated case of Michael Slater getting a tattoo of his player number on his ankle or his arse or something like that. And he'd got the wrong number. He'd got Brendan Julian's number.
Bit like the Geelong tourist to Thailand who, having had a very celebrating night, got 2007, gave the tattooist 2007 right and 2009 left. So he's getting 2009 here and 2007 here. Got 2007 right, 2009 left, actually tattooed on his arm. Next question.
Actually, interestingly, the England team have started doing exactly the same. I mean, in some ways, Australian cricket has been well ahead of the rest in introducing these ideas of continuity and tradition to their game.
From up the back here.
Thanks, guys. It's a very enjoyable Sunday afternoon. My question is to either of you. Are you aware of any other national team that attaches now such significance to some part of their cricketing apparel or equipment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't think it's the case. And in fact, the apparel of other countries undergoes quite. If you look at photos of players from the West Indies and England, there is actually no sort of continuity about the caps and the jumpers that they're wearing. If you look at the England team, there's the institution was St George and the Dragon used to be on the cap. Then there was the Three Lions. If you look at even England teams in the 1990s, wore a bizarre collection of apparel. A lot of England players preferred to wear white helmets to blue helmets, for instance. Obviously, they didn't feel as though they needed that kind of symbolic embodiment of their cricket, but. But I think it's come to be identified with success. It's come to be thought of as a bit of a secret of Australian success on the field, in the same way as sledging has, strangely enough. There's an absolute obsession in England with sledging about whether Australia is a better team for sledging, and maybe we should learn how to sledge as well. That would make us a better cricket team. It's absolutely standard operating procedure. If you go to England as an Australian journalist, you will get asked to write about a piece about sledging. It's kind of a bit ignominious, really. You know, England invented the googly, and West Indies invented the Chinaman, and Pakistan invented the doozer, and we invented you effing bastard. But no, in answer to your question, no. And I'd be interested to see whether it actually develops, because we might talk about this a little bit later, but because the grain of international competition is now competing with the grain of club competition and of private ownership through the Indian Premier League. And I wonder whether players feel quite the same sense of national attachment that they did maybe 10 years ago, when international cricket was basically the only game in town, whether they feel the same way about international cricket now, when playing in the IPL is so much more remunerative and so much more prestigious even. I don't know, perhaps we can talk about that later.
See, Gideon only talks... Sorry, you were going to follow up with a comment?
I've got another question.
OK, well, Gideon only looks through the lens of cricket, so let me answer that question with regard to sport generally. And I think the All Black jumper is an example of that. And I think if you were to go to... Not knowing specifically the intricacies of the cultures of, say, the 32 football teams who are playing in the World Cup,
But I imagine the Italian soccer jumper might have important symbolism in Italian culture. I don't know, but I would be very surprised if there wasn't this really a sense that it embodied something about that particular nation. And certainly the All Blacks, the Silver Fern, you know, there's great emotional attachment to that jumper. Your next question, and then we'll come down here.
Yeah, sorry to hog the floor. I'm interested in whether either of you know whether Greg Matthews ever, why he always used to bowl with his cap on.
I don't know.
I think that may have been to do with his steadily denuding tonsure.
Which has now been re-fertilised.
It has.
And in fact, they've now got 11s, English 11s against... Have you seen that ad on Fox Michael Vaughan or someone says, well, we've got Gucci and we've got so-and-so and so-and-so, and Warnie goes, well, we've got... And they've all had the hair transplants and... Why are we talking about that? Now, just here.
Vic Christophany here. Just a couple of comments. With the numbering system that's been mentioned, it's my understanding that the Aboriginal team of the 1800s, how do you fit them in when they were subsequently endorsed as Australians into a numbering system? And I understand they were given a subset, so
yeah,
not to compound the run of the serial numbers. And second observation is that there hasn't been any emphasis yet on baggy. And I've worn both the English-style cap and the baggy green type, not at that level, of course, but the versatility and functionality of the baggy green is that when the sun's low in the day, you can at least... It's got flexibility. You can turn it round and keep the sun out of your eyes, whereas the English-style of cap, a tight-fitting one, if you pull it down at the front, it comes up at the back and vice versa. And I think this is a much more versatile style of cap.
We have the Minister for Millinery here this afternoon.
Yeah, well
so
done.
Thank you for those comments.
Yeah. That's a very good comment, actually. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that they actually had that in mind with the original cap, but I'm glad to hear that you feel it's... It might be a latent benefit, but maybe that's one of the reasons why it's endured, and that one of the reasons why it's endured in a period where no one was paying all that much attention to it. If you talk to an Australian player of the 1960s, they'll say they actually didn't like the cap all that much. I've talked to Frank Misson, Lindsay Klein, players like that. They say, we thought of it as a bit dowdy or even maybe a bit flouncy. That was the word that Frank Misson used to describe it. And they thought the England cap was actually a little bit funkier, a little bit more fashionable. and if you talk to Bill Laurie, Bill will say that he... Well, he's got a few of his caps left, but he wore them in the pigeon coop, so they're covered in crap. So actually, maybe that's another latent advantage, that it's very useful in the pigeon coop. To answer the question about the Aboriginal team, yes, you're quite right. They were given a subset number. I actually feel a little bit ambivalent about that because... I understand the desire for inclusion and the desire to sort of to create an Aboriginal or an Indigenous cricket tradition in Australia, but I also think there's something kind of phony about it too, because we don't really have an Indigenous cricket tradition in Australia. We have isolated examples of good Indigenous cricketers and the avid pursuit of cricket in different areas by Indigenous players, but surely the point is that we haven't had that tradition in the past. And it kind of, to create that numbering system creates a continuity that I just don't think historically is there.
So why would you choose 1877? Why is that more official? In what
sense? Sorry, 1868.
No, if you say the first test is 1877, why would you choose that ahead of 1868?
You choose it because it's the first time that a team from Australia and a team from England meet 11-a-side in a game where the players have been drawn from the different colonies by a... in fact, funnily enough, the team in 1877 was not called Australia. It was called the Combined New South Wales and Victoria Team. Retrospectively, it's understood as the first test match. But at the time, no one went around saying, hey, it's great, isn't it, this first test match that we're just about to have. Yay for Australia. I think actually a much more important game is the one that I referred to earlier, where Australia beat MCC at Lord's in a day in 1878, where Fred Spofforth bowls the best, a much, much stronger team than played in that first Test match, out for 33-19. That really is the event on which Australian cricket really demonstrates its prowess to an English audience, bearding the lion in its own den.
Something of a parallel, I understand, with the 1928, I think it was, a rugby union team where New South Wales was basically the only state that played rugby. Queensland, I don't think, had taken it up at that time, or there was a gap in their fixtures. But that team, called the Wallabies, went to England as Australia, even though the selection was confined to New South Wales players.
Interesting.
So there's a bit something, but they still call them Australia. So there's a bit of a parallel there with the Aboriginal team.
Well, Australia won the rugby gold medal at the 1908 Olympics, remarkably. Bet you didn't know that. Well, man, you
did.
Now, a question at the front here.
My name's Kieran. I just wanted to ask you, Gideon, you alluded to earlier the big change that cricket has gone through in the last few years or so. I wanted to ask you whether you thought the baggy green might be at Test cricket saving grace in the future.
Once again, it's one of those things that, you know, I'd like to think it's the case. I'm never quite sure whether I'm answering rationally or sentimentally under circumstances like that. I think I'm glad to see I think that the Australian players are actually quite conservative, and players generally are. You know, this team has been very, very successful over a long period. They won't want to change too much about the way in which they play cricket and the kind of totems with which they surround themselves. But at the same time, if playing international cricket for Australia begins to significantly inhibit your ability to maximise your earnings, and the IPL is getting bigger every year. I think it's moving from 60-odd games to 94 games next season. That is an awful lot of 2020 cricket for Australian players who've signed up with IPL to play. They're going to be very tired at the end of that. They're not going to really want to play international cricket. They certainly want to play international cricket at the same time, or really either side of it. They'll want to keep themselves fresh for it, and they'll want to recover from it. IPL is kind of like the Godzilla of cricket at the moment. It's basically devouring everything in its path. And for as much as the players feel a sense of dedication, sense of duty, a sense of obligation to the cricket system that made them, they're also encouraged to think of themselves increasingly as autonomous agents maximising their earnings potential in a free market for entertainment. And the Aussie players love going to IPL. They're made to feel very special. They're paid a lot of money. They're treated like superstars, bigger superstars even than they are in Australia. I think players who've been brought up in the traditional system will continue to regard international cricket as a priority. The next generation, I'm not quite so sure of.
Maybe it's a good time then to reconsider that, the wearing of the CUB cap rather than the...
Yeah.
Does that suggest a commercial mindset ahead of a representative mindset?
Well, the curious thing about that is that I think the Australian players have tied themselves in knots with their veneration for the baggy green in that case. If you remember, the cause of them wearing that cap was that Brad Haddin had not been capped for Australia in a Test match, therefore he didn't feel entitled to wear a baggy green, so therefore, as an act of solidarity, the players wore the blue sponsor's cap instead, rather than have all the rest of them wearing a baggy green and one guy wearing something else. So the players were trying to be traditional in that case, but they ended up sending completely the wrong message, and I think they were trying to do the right thing, but it was misinterpreted. But it was interesting the way in which Australians reacted to the sight of their team playing under the tight-fitting bonnet of a vast commercial organisation. It kind of caused all sorts of alarms, and I think it touched off kind of a subliminal sense of alarm or a subconscious sense that maybe this sense of values that we pride ourselves on is subtly being eroded around us.
See, I'm interested too in 1977-78 when the best cricketers weren't playing for Australia. Mm. But nonetheless, there was this sense, certainly in our family, that the Peter Toohey side, you know, Bob Simpson, and that magnificent series against the Indian, it was the Indians, wasn't
it? Yes, that's right, yeah.
They were the Australian cricketers. Mm. Now, alongside of that, you've got Packer, Kerry Packer, running World Series cricket, and he, in fact, in your piece, I think, Gideon, you mentioned that he resisted, or he didn't want his players to use the baggy green.
That's
because
right.
He felt that that was the legitimate cap of the Australian cricket side. Mm, mm.
When the when World Series cricket was looking to outfit itself, they chose a golden cap rather than a green cap because Packer told Vern Stone, who was the general manager of World Series cricket, that you've got to earn those, son. You've got to earn those. So, I mean, of course, Packer was in initiating World Series cricket, was actually not trying so much to set up an independent cricket attraction, but to win the rights to broadcast international cricket in Australia for himself. He was trying to get the baggy green rather than to create his own baggy green. And by signing up the players, by signing up the world's best players and staging his own alternative cricket attraction in Australia, he was able to bend the authorities to his will. Although, interestingly, the first season of World Series cricket, the accent of the promotion was, these are the world's best players. These are the world's best individual cricketers. They are playing for lots of money. They are playing for more money than ever before. And you will see a higher standard of cricket than you have ever seen before. And, of course, as you remember, the first series of World Series cricket was not a success because there was quite an attractive official Australian series between Australia and India. The Australian team being led by the old stager Bob Simpson with a bunch of young lions around him, like Peter Toohey. And Geoff Thompson was in the Australian side too. In the second season of World Series cricket, 1978-9, Packer rather boldly and potentially it was quite a risky step. It could easily have blown up in his face. He initiated the campaign, "Come on, Aussie, come on." He said, "Well, we might not be wearing a baggy green cap, but this is the real Australian side. Look at the names in that side. Look at Dennis Liddy. Look at the Chappells. Look at Rod Marsh. These are the real Australian cricketers. Beware of imitations." It was almost like he was trying to convince the public that his Pepsi tasted better than the Coke of the Australian Cricket Board. And because the Australian cricket team, the official Australian cricket team in that second summer, were very soundly beaten by England 5-1, and the Australian World Series team actually had quite a successful summer, with the aid of that hype, with the aid of that advertising campaign, with the aid of those very charismatic Australian personalities, he was able to create a very successful cricket attraction with and occasion a patriotic pang at the same time. So even though I think fundamentally because of his conservatism, he kind of understood the way in which Australians relate to their cricket team.
Wasn't there a photo, you'll correct me, I'm sure, if I'm wrong, Gideon, but it might have been Waverley of World Series cricket, where in the background there is only one person in the entire stand.
Yes.
Didn't you find that person?
He wrote me a letter.
Oh, he wrote,
yeah, he wrote
a letter.
Me a letter. He was
one person in the entire grandstand. What was his name?
I've forgotten his name, but he was a student teacher, I think, and he had the day off, and he thought, oh, I'll go down to watch the first Super Test, and there was no one there, absolutely no one there. This was at Waverley, December the 2nd, 1977, and I can remember watching on television. Perhaps some of you were watching at the same time. It coincided exactly with the first Test. So you had the Test match on from Brisbane on the ABC, and you had the World Series Cricket Super Test on Channel 9. And the World Series commentators were making desperate attempts to make this sound like the most exciting innovation since penicillin.
It was a very overcast day, that first test in 1978 in Brisbane, and I was at Oakey on the Darling Downs doing my Maths 1 exam for Year 11. And I know this. I knew the score because Clive David Yeavesley, C.D. Yeavesley, was my English teacher, and he was a Welshman. And his brother, Tim Yeavesley, had taken a hat-trick against minor counties in 1973, which included Rowan Canhai and Sir Garfield Sobers.
Good Lord.
And I'm very nervous about my Maths 1 exam, and C.D. Yeavesley, who was always, you know, trying to dig the knife into us Aussies, put up first test score. I'm doing, you know, question 3B, first test Gabba, Australia 6 for 36. Hence, I did arts at university. We've got a question. No, we'll just wait for the mic there.
Thank you. My name's Andy Turner. My activity in cricket these days is as an umpire, notwithstanding the fact we had to leave our guide dog outside. But my observation of contemporary cricket is that international cricket is becoming less and less like the game that Gideon and thousands of other people play on a Saturday afternoon, and more part of the international entertainment business. Mm. And we could, if time allowed, pursue examples of that. But my question is, I say that to ask you this. In the discussion about the evolution of the baggy green as a symbol, to what extent might it be becoming a symbol which tries to tie the international game back to its roots? Because for practitioners, the two have less and less to do with one another.
Yes. Yeah, it's like I said, it's in periods of convulsive change that we have the most need for reassuring, wholesome reassurances about the direction of cricket. And I think it's no coincidence that the baggy green has achieved this eminence in a period where a lot of the values that it would be regarded as embodying have come under threat. I think it's a good point about the conflation of the values of cricket and entertainment. I think you see it very clearly in the IPL. Cricket is barely even a priority. I think the standard of IPL is actually really pretty poor. If you watch the games, and I have watched quite a bit of IPL because I like watching cricket, even if it's crap, but it looks ordinary. They're mainly Indian domestic players with a sprinkling of internationals. The games don't seem to me to be particularly intense. The standard of the fielding's really poor. The standard of the bowling's modest. The standard of the hitting is great, but that's, I think, largely because the grounds are small and the bats are really powerful. But that doesn't matter, because they've pre-sold the rights for more than $1 billion to Sony. Actually, they renegotiated the rights last year, and it's now $1.6 billion. Absolute telephone book numbers in Indian cricket. It's almost mind-boggling how large it is. We have no sense of how the gravitational pull of India is affecting our cricket on a daily basis here. And I think the expansion of the IPL next season to 94 games, I just shudder to think what it's going to be like. I mean, actually, we had a period recently where we had the 60 games of the IPL. I think we had the 40 games of the World 2020, and then we had three or four games of the South Africa West Indies, and we also had the Women's World 2020. So we had about 120 games of 2020 cricket in 10 weeks. By the end of it, I didn't know who was playing who. You wake up in the mornings these days and you simply do not know who is playing who. The cricket calendar's become not only incredibly crowded, but incredibly disorderly. That's one of the reasons why I think we love Ashes cricket so much, that we know when it's going to be in the calendar.
The other thing about that is for the economy of cricket, it doesn't matter that no one's going to Dunedin to watch the second test between New Zealand and England because the rights have been sold. But also another thing that people don't often think about is that the impact of gambling now on cricket. Gambling organisations are advertising and sponsoring everything because they've got so much money. And if they can encourage you to have a bet on New Zealand versus England, then that's more eyeballs on that screen, because if you've had your 100 on New Zealand to win by the end of the fourth day at 9-1, then you've got an interest in it, not only in terms of cricket, but also in terms of the punt.
Isn't that largely back to the future, in the sense that...
Going back to where cricket origins started in 18th century England as a vehicle for gambling. Mm.
John was mentioning the riot at the SCG in 1879 before, which Edmund Barton was the umpire of, and that happened because...
It was a run-out, wasn't it?
Well, there was a run-out of Billy Murdoch, and it caused uproar in the crowd because so many people had money on him scoring runs. There was basically a kind of a gambling ring operating in the pavilion at the SCG. Yes, we have gone back to the future, in the sense that, I mean, that the rise of cricket is intimately linked to the gambling culture of England. Before 1850, the efforts to purify the game of the gambling culture in England are actually what leads us to this idea that cricket is more than a game, that cricket is if you look at Reverend James Pycroft's the cricket field in 1850, the values that he claims for the game are chiefly those of purity and of a lack of corruption. It says that, you know, cricket has purged itself of these pernicious influences. Well, if cricket is going to conflate the values of sport and entertainment, then what does it matter whether the players are trying or not? What does it matter whether who wins and who loses? All that matters really is whether there are outcomes that we can bet on. If cricket is to become like a pop concert, like going to see a pop concert, you know, a sort of a guaranteed package, entertainment package, then the idea of it being a game, a competition, that it matters whether, you know, you win or lose, is significantly being eroded.
Just that mythology of cricket too. I mean, in my childhood, certainly it was, don't give your wicket away. There's almost a death mythology in cricket about survival, about just hanging on and hanging on. Mm. And yet now, you know, there'll be another test match next week and there'll be... I think the deeper meaning of it has altered if that's the way you're looking at it. Mm. We've probably got time for a couple more questions. There was a couple here, one, two maybe, and then three. So let's start here somewhere, wherever's closest. Thanks. Mike's coming.
Yes, my name's Alex. If we go back to the 1932 series of Bodyline, you know, Douglas Jardine, the English captain, is always synonymous with wearing a cap of the Harlequin club.
Yes.
So how was it that he actually wore the Harlequin cap? Was that because there was actually nothing else in existence?
No, because in those days the English weren't particularly precious about the caps that the players wore. Percy Chapman, the England captain on the 28-9 tour, wore his own club's cap, the Quidnunc's cap. In those days, one of the reasons why the baggy green is important, or the tradition of the baggy green is, I think, significant, is that we have always had the one cap in Australia. All players, whether they've played one test or 100 test matches, all wear the same cap. In England, because they have had a much longer tradition of the division between amateur and professional, between gentleman and player, up until the distinction was abolished in 1962, there's always been a greater sartorial individuality in English cricket, let's say. And Australians, because they've prided themselves on having a more egalitarian tradition, have said one cap for every man. There's something to be proud of in that. In that sense, the baggy green is very much a reflection of the way in which we feel as though we play our cricket.
The mic here, yep.
My name's Robert Goddard. Given the enormous amounts of money involved and the people who seem to feed off these prominent players as well, what influence do you think that these personal managers, each player seems to have their own manager, and is that going to impinge on what these young men decide to do and when they're going to do it and how they're going to do it and where they'll go?
Mm. Yeah, that's a very good question. I think about it quite a lot, actually. there are some very avaricious managers out there.
Across all codes.
Australian players, in my period as a journalist, have become increasingly inaccessible to the media. If it's not perceived to be in the players' interests, their commercial interests, then players don't want a bar of cooperating with you as a journalist. Really, you get very, very controlled access to players through very, very boring press conferences. And that's a source of great disappointment to me. I think cricket sets a very poor example in that respect. I think players from other sports feel a much greater obligation to be open to the media and to the public and to give an account of themselves and their game. I think it's one of the reasons why we don't have particularly good cricket journalism in Australia, because the players and the journalists have become so separated from one another. I think I'm not sure that it's actually happened yet, but I would not be surprised if in the next 3 or 4 years a player is encouraged by a manager to go and play in a more richly rewarding game than is on offer in his own backyard. You had the interesting example recently of the Victorian players opting to play in the Sheffield Shield final rather than going to represent their IPL franchises. That was ridiculous. All power to those players that they chose to play for their states, but they cost themselves an awful lot of money in doing so, in not going to play in IPL. And I know that from talking to Cricket Australia, the BCCI, who run cricket in India, are absolutely adamant. They are constantly reinforcing that Australian players must be available for IPL. I don't think they will in future accept Australian players preferring to play in their domestic competition. It's become a real bone of contention between the different boards. So it may not simply be the managers. It may be the commercial priorities of the BCCI that are as influential on what players do in future as managers.
With managers, it's not so much the encouragement to make an individual decision at a particular point in the cricketer or footballer's career. It's the fact that when the kid signs on at 17, grows up in a relationship with this manager where the manager is pushing getting the last dollar out, you know, that make sure you have to look after yourself commercially. You have to make sure. So you wouldn't believe some of the people who, when you ask them for interviews, when I was working for Inside Sport occasionally, I had a lovely column, a beer with so-and-so, and, you know, quite a few of them wouldn't do it unless they were paid $5,000. You know, not doing it, no. Mm. Well, you know, you've got your sponsor and they're getting an earn out of them sponsoring the column. We should have cut of that. And it's quite widespread. Last question.
Thank you. My name's Neil Fleming. A couple of observations. Going right back to the first question, it's interesting that the baggy green caps are not individually numbered, as we've already noted, but the one-day caps are. Ricky Ponting is 1, 2, 3, is he not? But another observation I recall watching the last Ashes series from England, or rather the first test from Cardiff, on the last day of... And was that on SBS at the time? I think... watching the last day as the Australians were in the field and the commentators were presuming the imminent Australian win that never came, there was a whole segment of about 30 minutes by the commentators with close-up shots of Australian fieldsmen all in their baggy greens, assuming the win coming on, and the crest openly visible, and then shots from the previous day of the English fieldsmen with their caps on, with their ubiquitous sunglasses, horror of horrors, shielding the crest on their caps. And this was a sign of the misdirection that the Englishmen were going through. The fact that we didn't win that test and then lost the next one seemed to get lost in the thread. But I think that's important in talking about symbolism.
I was reminding John of a wisdom of Steve Archibald. He played for Spurs. He said that team spirit is the illusion glimpsed in the aftermath of victory.
As that was an observation, we will have one quick last question.
John, my name's Lloyd Owen. I'm just wondering if you could check the Made In tag on that cap.
It is. This is from the Tomb of the Unknown Cricketer. It's anonymous.
Just wondering if it'd be great
Australian icon is actually made in Australia, or is it made in China?
Oh, sorry. Yes, it is Australian made. The caps are made by Albion C&D, and who are, of course, the world's leading manufacturer of batting helmets. And they've had that contract, I think, since the 1950s. There have been a variety of makers. Actually, that's something that we haven't talked about at all. Who makes the caps? There have been an extraordinary variety of makers. Probably the one who held it longest. Does anyone remember Farmers Department Store from Sydney? Well, they had the contract for years, and players, before they went off on tour, would go to be outfitted at Farmers and, you know, have their hat size taken, and the blazer would also be manufactured in their size. You just reminded me the mention of Ricky Ponting. I think one thing that's and it goes back to the question that Kieran asked before. Ricky Ponting, I think, is a real glass of fashion in Australian cricket these days. I think he's grown into his role as a kind of a representative of Australian cricket. And there is something significant about the fact that Ponting has retired from 2020 cricket. He doesn't play in the IPL. In fact, he very explicitly turned his back on IPL. Michael Clarke, his dauphin, doesn't play IPL either. I think from those role models, you do see that the senior Australian players do regard their international obligations as a priority, for all that they are savvy about their commercial value to the last decimal point. But I do wonder, as I said before, what the attitudes of the next generation will be.
Well, our expectations were high, and I think they might have been met. Engaging, uplifting, entertaining, eloquent. And while there's clearly an enormous amount of cricket knowledge in this room, you'd have to say the cricket knowledge with these two gentlemen is absolutely jaw-dropping. I'm not sure if it's healthy. Yeah. What do you think? I've got two prospects for you now. Whatever you think, we'd like you to fill in the questionnaire. And the book that you have been hearing so much about, Symbols of Australia, is in fact available in the shop right now, which will be open till 5 o'clock, $39.95. And if you do buy one, I'm sure that if you join us in the Friends Lounge for a cup of tea, that Gideon would be more than happy to sign it for you. I haven't cleared that with him, but I'm sure that's fine. The Friends of the National Museum have invited you to the Friends Lounge for a cup of tea and a bit more of a chat, and I think we could really do this for days by the sounds of things. We have a new director in the National Museum, and one of the things that he's been talking about in the last few weeks as he's arrived and got used to the place is that he's been reinforcing this idea that he wanted the museum to be a place where we were linking contemporary debate with history. And I don't think we could have had a better example of that here this afternoon. Can you join me in thanking Gideon and John?
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.